I celebrate myself and sing myself, and what I assume, you shall assume, for every atom belonging to me, as good belongs to you. So begins this nation's first great poem, Song of Myself, written by Walt Whitman and first published in 1855. Ever since then, the father of free verse has lived in the American imagination as the embodiment of a free man, unfettered, unbound by any dogma or dictum. Kim and Valerie Nuzzo have created a one-man stage show, which comes to the Temporary tomorrow night, and I had the chance to speak with Kim Nuzzo yesterday. Kim Nuzzo, welcome to Express Yourself. Well, we're talking because you are embodying a pretty amazing character named Walt Whitman. You know, it's been 199 years since Walt's birth and 164 yeah. years since Leaves of Grass, his seminal work, was first published. Why is he still a compelling character in the 21st century?
Well, I think, you know, in my view, it's because he really is, you know, I think he is the closest thing America has to what I would call a saint. and so his, you know, his economic presence just, it lives on. And as a lover of democracy and the democratic ideals, which I think, you know, we go through these phases in our country where they sometimes appear to be diminishing, but they come back. And I think one of the reasons that they come back is because there are ideals that our poets and artists and, you know, some of our famous, I'll use the word, agitators and freedom fighters, keep them alive. And that's the reason I think Whitman is still such a presence for us today, is it because he, you know, transcended this kind of messy democracy that we live in and held on to what are the beautiful ideals about it.
Huh. You know, it occurs to me that, you know, his book was first published in the run-up to the Civil War, and I'm sure that that was a pretty important event in his life, as well as the lives of all his colleagues and the people that he lived. Was he a man of his times?
He was definitely a man of his times, and I'm glad you mentioned the Civil War, because our play, one of the things that it focuses on, because our play is a type of historical fiction. It uses mostly Walt's words, both from his poetry, some important pieces from Leaves of Grass, but a lot from his journals, and specifically the book Specimen Days. But in our play, one of the ideas that we deal with is that Walt saw between 80,000 and 100,000 sick and wounded soldiers in Washington, D.C. in the hospitals during the Civil War as a volunteer nurse, unpaid, and every day would go to the hospitals and visit young men, mostly whom were in the process of dying. You know, by the end of the war, 18,000 had died in the hospitals of D.C. But Whitman, we believe, experienced what today we call PTSD from the trauma of how many young men he was close to and nursed who were suffering with really no hope of recovery.
Wow.
And, you know, that is a very important part of the play. And the other thing is that Whitman really believed that his poetry could stop the war.
Huh.
In his journals, he wrote, his exact words are, the war and my book are one. I thought if people would just read the poems, they would realize there is no difference between us. We have more in common than separates us.
How about that?
Yeah.
Not a popular view at the time.
No, it sure wasn't.
Although he had several bones to pick with abolitionists. I mean, you know, abolitionists were definitely, he was among them, but I mean, he didn't march in lockstep with them, did he?
No, that's right, Luke. He, you know, he had, and I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, we try to show that in our play too, the real Whitman. You know, he evolved like a lot of human beings do in his thinking about things. In the beginning, he more identified with the free soil movement, which was the idea that slavery would be banned in any of the new states coming into the Union. But, you know, over time, he began to identify more and more with abolitionists. And his mother was a follower of an itinerant Quaker preacher named Elias Hicks, who was an abolitionist. So, you know, on the one hand, he had his father's, his father's rather rigid views, and his mother's kind of warm acceptance of everyone. And he battled with those, but he eventually, you know, he evolved to more completely identify that, you know, slavery was abhorrent and needed to be gone forever.
Huh. Wow, how about that? Well, you know,
yeah.
So he had some Quaker antecedents. His parents were Quakers.
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah, and, you know, there were other things in his upbringing, too, that were significant. You know, it was a large family. He was the second child of eight. His father was kind of an unsuccessful builder who tried different things. He was probably alcoholic. He never read a word of Whitman's poetry. You know, he died when Whitman was 36, and you know, he took Walt out of school. You know, Walt, that's another thing I think is an interesting piece, how many iconic heroes we have that are self-made, self-taught, self-educated men, which Whitman was. He only had a sixth grade education.
Really?
Formal education. Even though he was, you know, he nurtured an envy for people with a classical education, so he went about educating himself by being a voracious reader.
Do you think that accounted for his populist tendencies, his championing of the common man?
Absolutely, I do. You know, he built houses with his father. He worked. He worked hard as a carpenter in different periods of his young life, and I definitely think that that was part of his identification with the common man.
So as a young man, he kind of frittered around the edges of newspapers. He was a little bit of a journalist, wasn't he?
That's right. And that, you know, that formed one of the ways that we looked at his life and found a way to write a play that has enough you know, conflict in it was by wondering about how this man, who was really, you know, a pretty mediocre, undistinguished journalist, all of a sudden in 1855 began to write, which many consider, you know, in that century, the most brilliant, unique, radical piece of literature written in that time. Well, how did that happen? It was almost, because it did almost happen overnight.
Huh. Did he sell his soul to the devil? How did that happen?
Well, our theory is that it grew out of the pain of having to deal with his own sexuality in a time when the word homosexual did not even exist. There was no such word. Mm-hmm. Dealing with that, and also the pain and PTSD of the suffering that he saw and experienced firsthand during the Civil War. Hmm. Both of those things. From that came some kind of, I guess I would call it some kind of spiritual awakening.
Feeling ostracized and
yes.
And in pain, spiritual pain.
That's right, exactly.
How do you embody that on the stage, Kim?
Well, it was first of all, I'd give a lot of credit to the woman, my wife, who directed the play. And that's Valerie Haugen-Nuzzo. Uh-huh. Because from the very start, one of her goals and focuses was, how do we bring, physicality to a little over an hour length play where there's just one person on the stage. And so, that requires one, bringing a lot of emotion. And a lot of that emotion came from this actual PTS experience that Walt goes through in looking back and thinking about the Civil War and thinking about what he saw in these hospitals. So there are some very dark parts of the play where Walt is really reliving these painful experiences that he went through. Hmm. And he also, from the very beginning of the play, is open about his sexuality, which I think is very disarming to audiences, because he actually talks about his one true male lover, Peter Doyle, and what it felt like when that relationship ended and Walt basically for some period of time just lived a lonely existence. And he's open about his list of one night stands. And this is a part that we wondered about how audiences were going to react. I remember the first time this a man in the audience who was from the Twin Cities came up to me after the play, and he said, when Walt talks about these one-night stands he has, it made me very, very uncomfortable. But I'm glad when something makes me very, very uncomfortable. It makes me take a look at something.
Hmm. So he fulfilled your objective, I'm imagining.
He did, really, absolutely. Huh. And I think that is a good question. Like, how does an actor, how does a work of art, embody that emotional piece? I mean, that's really the artist's job, I believe, is to somehow find that place in himself so that others can see it demonstrated in front of them, and that allows them to feel it in themselves.
You mentioned earlier the idea of having to carry the entire show just on your shoulders. An hour alone on stage is a challenge enough, but I'm thinking that in this case, an equal challenge, if maybe not a surpassing challenge, is how do you embody a man who's larger than life? How do you do that?
Yeah. Well, I don't think there's any magic to it. It's it's been something that we've been studying for a few years now. It didn't happen It didn't happen overnight. And I, too, probably like you, I'm not sure, but I, as a teenage boy in the early 60s, you know, carried around a copy of Leaves of Grass with me. So, you know, Walt Whitman is a person that that I have been able to identify with myself for a very long time. I'm not sure I could even describe exactly what it was. And maybe that thing that you mentioned before, it's maybe that as an adolescent, when you go through the angst of feeling like an outsider, that when you read someone else that embodies that feeling of being different, of being outside of the mainstream, you know, something happens. You know, Walt has never disappeared from me. And this play, when I talked to Valerie about it, it's not a play that I planned on doing once and then stopped doing. I'm 72 years old. I plan on doing Walt Whitman for the rest of my life. You know, I'm hoping to do it. I'm going to be doing it down here at the college for their English department. We've done it in Scotland at the Fringe Festival. I think it's a message that's universal that needs to be kept alive. So I think of it more as almost a personal mission to continue to bring, you know, Walt's message to the public. You know, a lot of high school kids I've talked to that have been at the play have told me they did not know who Walt Whitman was.
Huh. Wow. So it's sort of like Hal Holbrook performing Mark Twain.
And having I wouldn't put myself in that category.
No,
it is what I would like to do, is to continue to perform Walt wherever there may be an audience for him.
So how long have you been performing this?
This is the first performance that took place at our little theater, Zephyr Stage, here in Fruita. Last July, at the end of July, we performed, we did it 5 times here.
Okay.
And then from there, we took it to Scotland, to the Fringe Festival, where we performed it for a week.
Ooh,
every day.
That sounds fun.
That was great fun to do it in Scotland to an international audience. It was great. And then we brought it back here and have done it. You know, we had a full house at Thunder River Theater when we did it. And we've done it in Grand Junction. We've done it in Salida at the Steam Plant Theater there. Uh-huh. We're lined up to do it at Western States College, too, at the end of this summer. So it's been about.
It must be fun.
It is fun.
You know, standing there and as I said earlier, you know, embodying somebody larger than life, but what an amazing life and what an amazing outlook. I mean, I celebrate myself and sing myself and what I assume you shall assume. Isn't that how it goes?
And that's exactly how it goes. There are so many great lines from Walt, like, I bequeath myself to the dirt to grow from the grass I love. If you want me again, he's speaking to us. Look for me under your boot soles. You will hardly know who I am or what I mean, but I shall be good health to you nevertheless and filter and fiber your blood.
He was channeling something, wasn't he, Kim?
He was. That's right. He was. You know, he was speaking to generations to come. You know, he really was. He's really saying to us. You know, there's another line of his that he says, "I myself write but one or two indicative words for the future. I myself advance but a moment, only to wheel and hurry back into the darkness. I am a man who, sauntering along, takes a casual glance at you, then averts his face, leaving it to you. That means us, leaving it to you to prove and define it, expecting the main things from you. It's an invitation to us that this song of myself is really a song of ourselves.
Yeah.
And it's a river. It's a river of optimism that you must be carried on. You carry it on. I carry it on. If you have some belief or hope in the human experiment, you're with Walt.
I guess the reason, Kim, that he still resonates these days is because he was the first to have that all-embodying inclusivity, and he was the first to inject that into the public sphere.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Huh.
You know, he said each person has their place here in this procession, that life and the universe itself is a procession, and everyone has their place. So I don't know, at a time when we have these issues, dealing with, you know, issues about immigration, issues about inclusivity versus exclusivity, all of those things, Walt's message is very, very timely in terms of asking people to think about what is a democratic ideal.
Wow. Huh. Yeah. And, you know, in his time, it must have been absolutely shocking, the messages that
it was. It was, you know, Leaves of Grass was eventually banned.
Uh-huh.
You know, when Walt went to Washington, D.C., which he was invited to do on a steamboat filled with wounded soldiers, you know, where there weren't enough people to take care of him, he was invited to come to Washington. The way he supported himself were with little insignificant government jobs that he had, that he could only keep from time to time, because he was fired once by the Secretary of Treasury because he was judged to be a decidedly disreputable person, is what the Solomon Chase, the Secretary of State, called him. Secretary of Treasury called him. And, you know, and other bureaucrats in Washington thought his work was obscene. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so his book in his time was definitely not looked upon with, you know, great honor. There were some near the end of his life that were starting to recognize the brilliance of his poetry and how unique it was, you know, which is another thing. Walt is the more or less the inventor of free verse, which distinguished American poetry at that time. And now 90% of poetry written in the world is free verse.
Yeah.
That comes from Walt Whitman.
Yeah. 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 And yet he was capable of writing a very tender elegy upon Abraham Lincoln's assassination.
Yes. Yes,
several,
I'll say.
Several of them.
Several of them.
Yeah.
When lilacs last in the dooryard bloom, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, Captain, my Captain.
Oh, Captain, my Captain. When I was in grade school, high school, those were poems that you were asked to memorize. But I don't think they do that anymore. I don't know.
I think you're right. Yeah, maybe they make them remember hip-hop lyrics or something.
That's right. That's okay, too.
But, yeah. You know, isn't it interesting that 150, 60 years later, we have another group of people that was marginalized, and they are finding their empowerment in words just the way Walt Whitman did.
Absolutely. Yes.
So that's a universal thing, I guess.
Yeah, it is. The power. The power as well as the mystery of words and what they can do.
Yeah. Huh. Wow. Well, what a great subject. It sounds like it'll be a very interesting show over at the Temporary. And do you have plans to bring it back to the Valley again after that?
You know, I don't want to overdo it at this point.
Yeah.
No plans to bring it back. But, you know, I'm always looking for, you know, some of the audiences that you don't hit with a performance in a theater, like adolescents or in high schools or colleges, those kinds of things. So hopefully it will come back to the Valley at some point in the future.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Kim Nuzzo, I want to thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for embodying an American icon.
Thanks so much, Luke.